the review session on Wednesday, the 7th, after class. What do you need to know? Yes, Teresa. Yes, you need to know the theorists. Which ones?
Yes.
What?
Yes.
Which ones?
Which ones do you need to know?
Which ones do you need to know? Tell me, which ones do you need to know? Erickson, Sullivan, Piaget. Well, you know, should remember him. Who else? Bowen. Sternberg. Keniston. And Sullivan, we already said, I think. And one that you probably should pay attention to, he's in the study questions, and he's in the text fair amount, is Valent. I mentioned him in lecture one day without really emphasizing it because he was pertinent to a particular point I was making, but it's V-A-I-L-L-A-N-T, and he appears throughout the adulthood sections of the text. Chomsky on language, yeah. Chomsky on language. Kagan, temperament. Chesson Thomas, the New York Longitudinal Study. They're researchers, not really theorists. Bowlby flashed across the screen once, talking about attachment. Bowlby, B-O-W-L-B-Y. Ainsworth? Ainsworth, you can probably get away without knowing her name as long as you know the various styles of attachment or types of attachment. Any others, Julie, you can think of? Okay. That'll keep you busy. And then, of course, the real challenge is to figure out how they all fit together. Just as we think about now putting the three domains together, how would you take all of these theoretical positions, because each of the theorists is talking about some particular aspect of psychosocial development, and how would you fit them together? Yeah. They do fit together pretty well, but it's a real challenge. Maybe we should just make, no, I'm not even going to speculate on that, because I couldn't grade it anyway. Julie, would you make a note to remind me to flesh that out a little bit next year, the way the theorists all fit together? In the reading guide, one of the things that I was updating, I discovered was I was making connections between theorists two or three times in the reading guide, just reminding you that if we're talking about intimacy in adulthood, it might be appropriate to think about Sullivan and how he fits. I didn't do it in a systematic fashion, but I realized that's part of what I was doing, was pointing out places where Bowen or Sullivan or Erickson might be useful in thinking about a particular development. Would I ask a question about finding an example in your life for this course?
Kind of like going into college and moving to
Yes, I wouldn't word it that way. I would not focus it on your life. I would say find an example or describe an example. But I wouldn't make it autobiographical. But you're free to come up with your own examples and do that from your own life or wherever.
Could you give an example of what a thorough essay answer would be if you asked for something on integration and differentiation?
If I were to ask a question about differentiation and integration in the psychosocial realm, what would be a thorough essay answer? The thorough essay answer would look at a particular example. So the example would be well described so that I would understand from the description what we're talking about. And I would be able to see within it the undifferentiated state, and that would be described. A description of the differentiation that leads to two or more elements or components that have been differentiated from each other. And then I would see a description of the integration of those two or more components and how they now work together. To create something that is more complex in its structure or function than the undifferentiated state. So an example of the relationship between differentiation and integration has to have the process of differentiation, which means you have to have the before and the after of the differentiation. So going from undifferentiated to separate or different, and then how those particular parts get integrated into something that operates in a more complex fashion. The typical problems in those essays are either leaving out the undifferentiated state and just saying the two things get differentiated, but I don't know out of what, or leaving out the end state, the more complex workings, or splitting it in the middle and using one example to talk about differentiation and then switching to something completely different to talk about integration. And that destroys the relationship between the process within the example. Yes.
Can you give me a story on like the last
Yeah, everything will connect somehow to psychosocial development. That's Julie's job, to make sure that it does. But many of the questions will ask you to connect the psychosocial to one or both of the other domains. Pardon? Three out of four essays, yes. 10 points each on those, potentially. And multiple choice, what did I say? 65 to 75. Depends on when we run out of questions. Julie's writing 15 a day from now on. And she's looking at me to find out if I'm really serious. No, she's not. Maria Montessori, probably not. I used her because of her background in her contribution to Erickson's notion, but I'm more concerned that you know what his concept is rather than where it came from. So we won't ask that. And who are they? Freud? Who's the last one?
Eichmann.
When? Right before Maria Montessori. Eichmann. Oh, I don't know. I do know of an Eichmann in the. The Freud, there was an Eichmann in the Freud Vienna circle, but I can't imagine that I actually talked about him, so I'm wondering what I mispronounced. The difference between Sigmund and Anna, no, those haven't been applied in the text. Those are some of the old dead white folks that text writers think they have to mention. That's true. They are all old dead white folks. You know, that's just they are, and you have to talk about them because somebody expects you to, but you don't. You're not obligated to integrate them or explain them or use them in any fashion. Bronfenbrenner is mentioned, and it's there. It is, and it's never mentioned again. It's in the Perspectives chapter, and it's never mentioned again in the text, and it's never used in any fashion in the text. So, you know, why bother? Because somebody says there are 1,000 things you have to put in a lifespan textbook, and Bronfenbrenner is one of them, even if you don't understand him or ever use him. So there he is. And he's now, as of a couple of months ago, one of the old dead white folks. You should know the 8 psychosocial stages in Erickson's theory and have some sense of the order in which they fall. I won't ask you to repeat them, but I will ask you to differentiate characteristics of them. So it helps to know sort of that generativity is not the major psychosocial issue for 3-year-olds and when it is. I shouldn't say this. I started to say they're sort of self categorizing. Sort of they fall into place naturally, but I realized that they probably didn't when I first read them either. So they do for me because it's my brain is wrapped around them. But that probably took a while, so yeah, you should probably know them. All 9 temperament characteristics from the New York Longitudinal Study of Temperament by Chess and Thomas. No, probably you shouldn't. If you saw 3 or 4 of them, it might be helpful if they sort of tripped the switch in your head that said, aha, those are aspects of temperament. Activity level, perseverance, distractibility, arousability, threshold of arousability, things like that. But I won't ask you to repeat them or identify which is or is not a characteristic of temperament. There are too many of them. 8 and 9 is too big. I'm still trying to figure out who Eichmann is. I talked about Peter Bloss, but you don't have to know anything about him. Autonomy. Yes, autonomy is an important kind of concept, and the text talks about it in 2 or 3 places, and it is a confusing concept. So let me talk about it generally and in a couple of places more specifically. Let's do the specifics first. Autonomy is, in Erickson's theory, the second stage. So after trust being the first issue, trust and mistrust, autonomy is his second issue, and then initiative is his third. What he's describing as autonomy is the characteristic of kids as they leave toddlerhood and develop some language, they learn the word no. And that ushers in a period during which the struggle for them is to figure out how to be separate people from their caregivers. And that follows the process of developing attachment and figuring out whether you can trust other people, then you have to figure out how to be separate from them. So the 2-year-old is experimenting with having her own will, having the ability to defy the caregiver, to establish herself as a separate person. And that Erickson and a lot of other people describe as working toward having a sense that you are separate from other people, that you have your own ideas and your own thoughts and your own will. And one of the ways you do that is to say no, and to say, I want to do it myself. I'm not going to let you do everything for me. I'm going to do some things for myself. So there's a piece of will in it. There's a piece of what we call agency. You don't have to remember that. I don't think the text uses that term. But there's a sense that I can be active in my own life, and that the actions that I take are different from what other people might want me to do or do for me. So it's the beginning of developing that sense that you are a self, that you are a person. And it's an important part of developing self-concept, because part of what ushers it in is the child's awareness, the beginning awareness that he or she is a specific and separate person. Okay. Later, Erickson and Keniston and others talk about autonomy as creating separateness from the family. And it's the same issue, but on a more complex level. And probably I should say generally that auto refers to self. You are autonomous when you do things for yourself. And the autonomy that we're trying to create in relationship to families is, again, what the two-year-old is going through, but at a more complex level of making our own decisions and establishing our own view of ourselves, our own identity. So that in adolescence, the autonomy is based on having become more like your parents physically. As you go through puberty, you become an adult. And more like them intellectually as you become formal operational. And you have to figure out, you get to figure out who you are yourself, and the process of creating a sense of identity is to establish that sense of your own identity and doing it yourself, not letting other people define you. So in adolescence, the issue in autonomy is figuring out how to identify yourself, how to create or construct a notion of who you are. At two, autonomy is in action. In adolescence, it's action, but it's also the conceptual, intellectual awareness. Another aspect of dealing with autonomy in adolescence is realizing that you are inevitably different from other people. You are an autonomous person, meaning that nobody else can ever inhabit your head. You may let them into your head, but nobody else can feel what you feel in the way that you feel it. Nobody else can know your thoughts. You can share them, but nobody else can actually think them. You may have a wonderful relationship in which the other person can read your mind, but that means the other person knows you well. It doesn't mean the other person is really inside your head. And that's a sometimes disturbing part of autonomy, of recognizing that you are autonomous, and in fact, you're on your own. You can reach out for assistance, you can share your life with other people, but it is up to you whether you do that. And that's a huge chunk of difficulty for many of us in adolescence, to wrestle with the fact that we in fact are responsible for ourselves ultimately. We do have to make choices. We do have to take responsibility. The consequences of our actions are ours. And some parents encourage that and support it, and other parents fight it. Some parents don't want you to be autonomous. They don't want you to make your own decisions. They don't want you to be out from under their influence and control. And other parents are quite happy to help you do that. So some parents are hanging on, other parents are letting go, and that becomes the issue of autonomy from them. You can also think about autonomy within Bowen's notion of emotional maturity and differentiation, because part of the differentiation there is accepting your own autonomy, that your feelings are your feelings and no one else's, and that other people have their feelings and you don't have to have theirs. So even though feelings are contagious, emotions are contagious, you don't have to feel what other people are feeling. So if other people are angry, you don't have to be angry. And if you're angry, that doesn't require everybody else to be angry. So dealing with your emotions as your own, on your own, and being responsible for them is another form of autonomy. And in undifferentiated relationships, people lose that autonomy or they've never developed it. So people get enmeshed with each other. They sort of merge with each other, so they don't have a separate self. They're living other people's emotions. And that tends to lead to emotional turmoil. And I guess the final way I would talk about it, this would make a great essay question. For some course, I don't know which one, but the other way I would talk about it is maintaining your sense of self while you're in a relationship. And again, that connects to Bowen's notion of being separate and being together. The separate part is the autonomous part of the relationship. The togetherness part is the non-autonomous. And so the challenge in adult relationships is to figure out how to be an autonomous human being while being married and partnered with and living with and sharing all of your resources with another person. And how to maintain that sense that you're still responsible for yourself. And that's difficult. In many relationships, it's difficult because people don't want the other person to be autonomous. It scares you if you think that your partner can actually make her own decisions or take care of herself. Some of us need to be needed, and that defines a relationship for us, when in fact a very mature relationship may be between two people who don't need each other but want each other. And that's a real difference. People who know that they can live quite well on their own and be perfectly happy and have chosen to be with each other, and that takes a lot of the anxiety out of the relationship, when you've chosen to be with somebody but know that you don't have to be. Then the threat of the relationship, the potential threat, is gone. And when you know that the other person doesn't have to be with you but has chosen, doesn't have to be, doesn't need you, can live her life perfectly well without you, and probably would, that's a really nice feeling, to feel that somebody has chosen you. Doesn't have to be with you, but has chosen you. Yeah, wow. Now, we all should have such good partners. And then the relationship is free, because the people are free. And it's a relationship that is a choice, and you can then go about enriching the relationship, but you don't have to create dependency. That's probably something we'll explore more in 60. But it is a significant part of the psychosocial development of adulthood to establish autonomy and to maintain it in relationships. And to maintain it in a parent-child relationship, that's also important. To realize that your kids have their own lives. And they don't have to tell you everything. And gradually, they have to make their own decisions. Thank you for the opportunity to give that mini lecture on autonomy. Probably everybody's afraid to ask another question because they're afraid I'll do the same thing. Try me. What else do you want to know?
What's maturity?
Right. Yeah, I know. What's maturity? I'll let you know if I ever get there. What have we talked about that relates to maturity?
Developing identity.
Okay. Developing a sense of identity would be a step in the way toward maturity. It's a little hard to think about a person as an adult or mature who doesn't have a sense of identity. I know some, and it's hard to think of them as mature adults. There's some wonderful literature on, and very thought-provoking literature on trauma and stress, some of which is being rediscovered in thinking about post-traumatic stress disorder, some old literature on the shattered identity, what happens when something really traumatic happens to you. From an Ericksonian point of view, is that it often is extremely difficult to pull the pieces of your life back together so that they make sense. And the process of recreating a sense of identity when it has to take into account some very traumatic event that's happened, that process is very difficult for many people. And they often, it's often easy to compare them to adolescents in their behavior and the way they go about things, because they're not operating consistently. They don't have a consistent view of themselves. Bowen talks about maturity, his notion of emotional differentiation. Is a way of defining maturity, that people who are highly differentiated are mature, people who can deal with emotion and think at the same time are mature. So he provides us a hint there, a clue. Maturity is one of those tough concepts because it's always relative. If you think about a 2-year-old, there are relatively mature 2-year-olds, and then there are immature ones, and it's interesting to think about how we differentiate them, or adolescents, or adults. There's always some reference to a norm within that notion of maturity, and so it's helpful to think about what the norms are at different points in life. There's another way we use the term mature. We haven't talked about it, but just to throw it out. When a particular set of skills or a particular understanding or a particular personality issue or psychosocial issue have been dealt with, they've been wrestled with, and you're comfortable with them and you've consolidated the skill, then we would say you've reached a mature state in that regard. So, for example, I could talk about maturity of formal operational thinking, and the adolescent wrestling with formal operations is still trying to consolidate them and make them all fit together and get comfortable with abstract thinking. And so I could refer to that as an immature state of formal operational reasoning. The person hasn't quite gotten there yet. And when I talk about college as a place to consolidate formal operational reasoning, I'm assuming that by the consolidation of that, it's going to be comfortable and familiar and relatively easy to be formal operational in your thinking, and I would say that was then a mature state of formal operational reasoning. Thinking about identity as another example, I can talk about an immature state of identity formation where I'm still experimenting. I may be playing around with negative identities. I may be experiencing crisis and anxiety or foreclosure every once in a while. So I'm in that process. I would say I was in an immature state of identity formation. But after I get to that sense, at least for the first time, and things are hanging together and I've got a sense of who I am, and I'm feeling that enduring sameness that Erickson describes across all my activities and relationships, then I would say I have a mature sense of identity. but it can be relative to the specific task that we're talking about. Your parents may have another definition of it for you, but again, that's relative to their norms for you. Bowen. Okay, the question is, in Bowen's notion of togetherness and separateness, which he describes as a two opposing forces, that we have these two tendencies, and they're inevitably in dynamic tension with each other. When I describe that as a continuum, as he does, with extreme separateness on one end and extreme togetherness on the other end. He's using that to suggest that where you are because of your development and probably your temperament, your personality, your experience with other people, you have a general comfort zone. And that's all of us have it. He did play around with the idea that there might be a genetic component to that, of how close we want to be with other people, but he didn't go very far with that. So it comes across as sort of a trait. This is a characteristic on which we differ, that people have different comfort zones, different degrees of sociability or need for autonomy. Right. The observation that you're making, that it might vary across different relationships, is probably a useful notion. That I might, although I would have a little difficulty wrapping my mind around the idea that people would have quite different comfort zones in different kinds of relationships. That would be an interesting notion to explore, but I don't have a sense that he had an idea about it. He describes it more generally as a position, but I don't recall, and I'm not an expert on all of his writings, so I don't know. Julie's been studying him, so but nothing specific that either of us know that he talked about it varying very much. I can imagine having somebody who's trying to relate to you who drives you nuts and you want to stay away from them, but I think that's kind of a different concept. Normative crisis model. The text describes what? Four different ways of approaching looking at development. And one of those four ways is the normative crisis model. And one is the, what are the others? One is a trait model. timing of events is the third. And the fourth is probably a stage model.
Typological.
Oh, the typological, okay. The models differ in how they account for differences among people and what they think is important to look at in understanding life and development generally. The normative crisis model is sort of a stage model, and the best example of that is Erikson, I think, where the notion is that there's a set of stages that are normative. We're all going to go through them. They are the norm. And we're going to go through those, and development is going to consist of wrestling with particular challenges. It's pretty much the Ericksonian notion that there are going to be different challenges that you're going to go through at different times, and that's what's going to make up development. That's going to be an important guide to what you're dealing with at any particular point. That those come at you, as Erikson describes, from within as well as from without. The timing of events model is the one that usually gets contrasted with the normative crisis model. And that one says that there are certain events that are going to take place across a lifespan. And those events are going to be a combination of things that you choose to do and things that you're forced to do or that happen to you. And that development is going to be primarily focusing on when those events happen, thus the timing, and how you deal with them. So what's going to be important in creating structure for your life is when you go through puberty, when you start to date, when you make a commitment to another person, when you get married, when you have kids, and that you're going to be different from other people because the events that you experience will be different from some other people, and the timing of those events will be different. And those models look at the difference between people who get pregnant at 16 and people who get pregnant at 25 for the first time, and people who get pregnant at 45 for the first time, and people who never go through that event. So they're looking at how those events are different depending on when you go through them. They'll be looking at differences between people and how the differences relate to everything else. Or, for example, when you get married or if you get married. And then they're interested in how you deal with early marriage as opposed to how people deal with late marriage. Okay. Or on time. And those models tend to look at when the average person does things, or when they're expected in the society, and whether you're on time or off time. So for those researchers, the interest often comes down to if the norm in the society is to get married at 25, how is getting married at 16 different? And how are people who don't get married until they're 35 different? Or the fact that you'd never get married, how does that change the course of your life? How is life different? The other two haven't been talked about much at all in this course or this text. The trait model looks at differences among people in things such as togetherness and separateness, and says that those traits, the differences among us in how intelligent we are, how sociable we are, how emotional we are, how shy we are, those sorts of things create the structure of our relationships and our lives. And typologies break people up into types. So they'll say, well, there are 12 types of people and they have this kind of life and they're different. From my perspective, they're all useful for different purposes. And like the theorists, it's helpful if you think about putting them all together and look at how they relate to each other. For the exam, there's probably a question about a normative crisis or timing of events model and how they're different, but nothing on typology or trait models. The typology and trait models really aren't particularly developmental. The other two are developmental models. What should they be asking, Julie? What?
I think those have been some great questions.
They have been really, really good questions. The review sessions next week, the times that I have requested are 2 o'clock on one of those days. I've forgotten whether it's, I think it's 2 o'clock on Wednesday and 3 o'clock on Thursday. And what do you need? Wednesday's a great day because there are no exams, so every room on campus is pretty much open. Thursday's harder because there are a lot of exams on Thursday. But there are rooms available. I just don't have confirmation of them yet. But I think I put 1 at 2 and 1 at 3. I did. Okay. Julie has the list. 2 on Wednesday. 3 on Thursday. I had to work around a meeting I had on Thursday. I'm sorry. Ah, which one did you miss? I'm sorry? After intimacy comes generativity versus stagnation. That's 7. And after generativity comes integrity versus despair. And Joan Erickson suggested a 9th. And I've forgotten what she suggested it be called, but it was based on her experience of being 90 and 92 years old, something like holding it all together.
What are the ages for the last 2?
I don't like to give ages for the last, because Erickson actually didn't give them ages very much. He says that generativity is the normative stage of middle adulthood, and generativity of later adulthood, but he didn't define what that meant. So the text, I believe, does apply some years, but they've imposed that. I think it's actually more consistent with Erickson's own writing to think of the last three as the cycling, coming around again, rather than being ascendant. He had a little difficulty with the timing and differentiation of those three in some of his thinking. But it's consistent with his notion that there are connections to all eight at every stage. So it would be appropriate to say that you're going to have the generativity issue, and that may challenge intimacy, and being generative, producing children or creating something may have implications for intimacy. You may have the intimacy issues all over again if you get divorced, for example. So you're dealing with a new version of intimacy, creating a shared history with somebody new when you remarry or when you start dating again, after you've already focused on generativity for a while. And you also may be wrestling with a sense of integrity about some of the earlier actions that you take. So when intimacy falls apart and you get divorced, then you have challenges. This is going way beyond the question, but it's interesting for me to speculate about that. As you're experiencing a crisis in intimacy when a relationship breaks up, you're wrestling with how to continue to be generative if you have children and carry out your responsibilities as a parent with your children. And there's also a challenge to integrity as you have to rethink the nature of the relationship that's ended and why it ended and what you did and whether you did the best you could have. And so those three issues, I think, are a little harder to specify for particular phases of life. Life just gets more complicated when you're an adult, for some of us. You think yours is complicated? Try to understand adulthood. If I ever do, I'll let you know. Yes. I'm sorry, could you repeat?
You put a lot of facts about the life history of...
Oh, life history of Erickson. No, you don't need to know those things. I think it's important in thinking about any theorist to understand something about where the theory came from. And in Erickson's case, the intellectual foundation of his theory helps us understand what he was doing. So I gave you that as an example.
And my second question, can you kind of like maybe clarify using like the example of the epigenetic principle? I wasn't very clear.
Okay, the epigenetic principle. The epigenetic principle actually comes from biology, and is I'm hesitating because I'm trying to remember the Greek root of epi. The Greek root of epi. It has to do with timing, and I'm just. I'm blocking on it. But it's the root of words like episode and I think actually epitome too. It refers to models and to sequences of things. And the epigenetic part is a word that's used to mean that the structure and the changes that take place in that structure are built in. They are within the model. So that the timing of change is intrinsic to the organism. And it comes from way before our understanding of genetics. But what it means is that the sequence of events is driven by the biology and specifically by the genes. The structural changes are built into the thing itself. And so its earliest examples are from embryology. And as Erickson puts it, and I had the definition on the web and on the board, the epigenetic principle means that every living thing has a sort of a schedule, a blueprint that's built into it. And that applies to the biology of human beings. But what he extended it to was that we also have built into us a sequence of stages of psychosocial issues that just simply come with being human. And they're clearly tied to the structural changes, the biological changes. But the epigenetic principle means that you don't have to look elsewhere to find that sequence of stages. He says they're built in. And that societies will reflect them because societies have evolved with human beings. So our societies assume that we are going through those biological changes. So societies accept and expect the epigenesis or the changes that we're going to go through, both the biological and the psychosocial. Epi, would you make a note?
Yeah.
I'm just blocking on what its origin is. You hungry? Go for it. Thank you. Thank you for the great questions. And have fun studying and get lots of sleep. I'll